Good evening.
Good evening.
It's always wonderful to sit in community and just feel how still everything gets. Very sweet. So Rich asked me for a title of this talk, and so I had to remind myself what I told him. So this talk is called Tending and Befriending. Is that too loud?
No.
An open-hearted response to difficult emotions. And Rich was saying that, you know, over the last month or something, you've been working with difficult emotion or the topic of that. And I wanted to bring a different perspective. So the subtitle on the talk is Cultivating an Open Heart is Both Practice and a Result that Transforms Our Relationship with Difficult Emotions. And so I want to explore that a little with you tonight. Tending and befriending is a phrase that was first coined by psychologist Shelley Taylor and her colleagues from a paper that was written, a research paper that was written in 2000. And some of us have heard the phrase fight and flight. And they suggest that there's also a different response. And in their paper, they were looking at women in particular, that most of the studies were studies of men. And it was interesting that women, in particular, could have a response that was tend and befriend. And it doesn't mean that it's strictly, you know, a gender line, but what I want to suggest is that there's a different response that we can cultivate that's different than the fight or flight response to stress or maybe threat. So Shelley describes tending as involving nurturant activities designed to protect the self and offspring that promotes safety and reduces stress. So think of how you might protect yourself. Think in the context of maybe a woman who has a child, and that tending is something that she would do to protect that offspring, protect that child or children and herself. And befriending is the creation and maintenance of social networks that might aid in the process. So I like to think of it in a larger context in terms of a society. That when maybe disaster strikes, we sometimes see this tending and befriending that arises, that you know, if there's a natural disaster or some danger, that, you know, people don't think, oh, you know, I don't know you, or I don't like your political stance, or I don't like your religion. People just help one another. You know, we don't qualify that help. We just reach out and help each other. And so I see that as also a very important survival mechanism that can arise. So Shelley goes on to say that the biobehavioral mechanism that underlies the tend and befriend pattern appears to draw on the attachment caregiving system. Attachment not being in the Buddhist context, but in the psychological context. And neuroendocrine evidence from animal and human studies suggests that oxytocin may be at its core. So some of you may have heard that a 20-second hug generates a lot of oxytocin. And it's a little bit of that feel-good quality, but it also is a bonding. It helps us to connect socially with one another. So this tend and befriend mindset seems to support physical resilience. And one of my senior CCT teachers, so I think Rich alluded to that I've had training in a protocol designed at Stanford called CCT, which stands for Compassion Cultivation Training. And so one of my senior teachers from there, her name is Kelly McGonigal. She's written a book recently called The Upside of Stress. And she suggests that helping others increases the chemistry of hope and courage and dampens fear and despair. And so she goes around suggesting that stress gets a bum rap. And that people who are told, so they've done some studies, people who are told stress is actually good for you have a different outcome than people who think stress is bad. It's kind of an interesting switch on the perspective. But that in certain cases, stress can motivate this tend and befriend, or maybe cause that to arise. And if we come from this tend and befriend perspective, that we get a lot of health benefit from that, from the social connection, from this mutual support in a way. So two researchers from Northwestern University that were cited by Kelly asked 150 middle-aged adults to tell the story of their lives. And they gave a narrative. And from the study, which was published this spring in April, they found that the stories from those who had the highest concern for and commitment to promoting the growth and well-being of future generations, so that means more likely to engage in a wide range of pro-social behaviors, including positive parenting styles, political participation, and community volunteerism, shared a similar theme that supported them. And the theme had five elements. So the narrative of these people looks something like this. They enjoyed some kind of early advantage in their life. They exhibit sensitivity to the suffering of other people. They developed a clear moral framework, and they repeatedly transform negative scenes into positive outcomes, and they pursued pro-social goals for the future. What's interesting is when I wrote those out, it sounded a little bit like the Buddha's life. He grew up with an advantage in his early life. And he was exposed to suffering and felt some sensitivity to that. Right? He was motivated by his exposure to these heavenly messengers of suffering. And his Eightfold Path is clearly a moral framework. And it's the transformation into positive outcomes. It's kind of interesting, right? Transforming suffering. And so this personal suffering inspires these types of people to do something to transform the suffering of others into something positive. So I looked in the Samyutta Nikaya, because I was trying to remember the details about the Buddha and his awakening. There's a scenario in which the Buddha's kind of sitting there after awakening, thinking, wow, you know, this knowledge that I have, this path that I just took to awaken, might be really difficult to teach, really hard for people to get. And so he actually was inclining not to teach, but just to just have a life, you know, of just an awakened life, but just resting with ease, right? And the story goes that Brahma Sahampati came down and beseeched the Buddha to teach. So I want to read this little bit of a verse here. So this is from the verse of the Samyutta Nikaya. He says, just as one standing on a rocky crag might see people all around below, so, O wise one, with all-around vision, ascend the palace fashioned of the Dhamma. Free from sorrow, behold the people submerged in sorrow, oppressed by birth and aging. So this was the plea that Brahma was asking the Buddha. Now that you are all seeing and you can come from this place that's free from sorrow, look back at all of these people who are submerged in sorrow and oppressed by birth and aging. He says, rise up, hero, victor in battle. O teacher, wander without debt in the world. Teach the Dhamma, O Blessed One. There will be those who will understand. And so the Buddha, out of compassion, surveying the world with the eye of an awakened one, saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and those with much. Those with keen faculties and those with dull. Those with good attributes and those with bad. Those easy to teach and those hard. Some of them seeing disgrace and danger in the other world. And he thought about it. Contemplated that. And then he agreed to teach. So that's interesting, right? That we have to come from a place that we actually know. That we know what suffering is like. And the Buddha coming from a place where he's transcended, where has awakened from that suffering, looks back and says, oh, I'm touched and I'm moved by that. And out of compassion, I'll teach. Because he knew, oh, this is going to be hard. This isn't going to be easy to teach everybody. So I feel that that's just really so touching. And so Kelly McGonigal supports the idea that tending and befriending can be strengthened by reframing our relationship to stress. And I want to point out that there's a monk in our tradition, Ajahn Dhanasuru Bhikkhu, who likes to use the word stress in place of the word dukkha. And so what would happen if we reframed how we approach dukkha? That maybe that reframing makes it more conducive for a tend and befriend response to arise rather than a fight or flight response. And this is where I feel that developing an open heart is an important practice element that creates the conditions for tending and befriending, and that's also a resultant of our practice. That is, the open heart is something that we try to cultivate, but in the cultivating of it, we also get the open heart. And in my own practice experience, and even in what I've seen from others who have engaged in this path, you know, we come and we bring in our cultural habit patterns. And at least for me, and some of what I've seen, is that we have a culture that tends towards a doing and fixing mentality. And you know, you might consider how many of you here in this room have some agenda of becoming a better person, you know, than you are, or that you're maybe here, or you go on retreat and you're attempting to acquire something like a special state of mind or some special meditation experience. And while that might be a wonderful motivation that might be helpful to keep us practicing, sometimes there's a subtle or sometimes not so subtle result from that. And that is that there might be this little element of fight or flight that creeps into our practice that tends to sabotage it. So the idea, I'll be a better person when I can stop my thoughts, or when I can achieve jhana, or when I finally have, you know, a silent place to meditate in, or, you know, if only that person that sat next to me in the hall was just quiet. You know, it's just a substitution for I'm not happy with this moment just as it is. And often there's a little inner conflict or a little tension where judgment starts to arise. And maybe the judgment that this emotion that I'm feeling is somehow bad, or it shouldn't be here, or I shouldn't be having this emotion. I'm a bad Buddhist if I experience anger, or if I'm experiencing depression. And so we have this perception it's not okay. And this little bit of fight or flight creeps in because it's like, I'm fighting with that. I don't want that. So I'm in conflict. Or I want to flee from that because that's not okay. And so I actually want to go into distraction to get away from that. Where I, you know, I just think, oh, I'm going to beat this, and I, you know, and this striving comes in, which actually is detrimental to this practice. Sharon Salzberg wrote in a recent article for On Being, dukkha, suffering, the sense of dis-ease in our lives, no matter what you want to call it, arrives most achingly not from uncomfortable circumstances, but from our reactions to them. Culturally, we are all taught to turn away from pain, to disguise it as if it were disgraceful. Or if we don't disguise it, we label it or judge ourselves for feeling it, and become the person in the chariot worrying about the effects of the ill-fitting wheel. We feel isolated rather than seeing our pain as part of the human condition. If you really think of the inner contortions we go through to avoid certain feelings, or when we dislike certain emotions, reflections, or perceptions, or things we don't want to see about others, it gets to be a pretty small space we're operating within. So we can get really tied up with that ill-fitting wheel, that dukkha, that rough ride. And we can get into the fix-it mode of, well, what can I do to make that wheel a little smoother, and can I oil it, can I do this, and can I do that? And we actually don't settle. But instead, we turn it into a project. So the more I practice, the more I start to just really appreciate that this practice is all about meeting this moment as it is, and finding that it can be okay in a spacious and open heart. And one of the most important pieces for me is orienting toward that tend and befriend aspect, toward whatever it is that arises, and that it's through a simple formulation that I actually learned through my compassion training, and this was a formulation that Kristen Neff came up with, and she's an author of a number of books on self-compassion, and she's a self-compassion researcher and teacher. And she calls it a self-compassion break. Some of you may or may not have heard about it. I don't know if Valentine taught that. But, it contains the essence of the Buddha's teachings in three simple reflections that we can do. So the first reflection is to recognize when we're struggling, when we're having difficulty, when we're in pain, whenever we are experiencing this thing called dukkha, that this is a moment of suffering. And I think this is a really crucial step. Sometimes we overlook, because we have to be radically honest to ourselves, to acknowledge and recognize the suffering in ourselves without pushing it away, but rather allow the intimacy of that sting or that pain to touch us, to touch our heart. And this is the essence of mindfulness practice. But we often get sabotaged by not really allowing the suffering to really come in and touch us. You know, we sometimes have a concept of pain, or we have aversion to something, and instead of actually recognizing it, you know, we immediately push away from it. And we don't let it actually come in. We don't actually let it touch, and we get the real visceral feeling of, ow, that hurts. Ooh, that's painful. Oh, this is suffering. Because a lot of times we're not fully bringing it into light. It's a little bit like naming the dragon or naming the wizard. We have to actually say, this is really true in this moment. Sometimes in meditation practice, you know, I know I've been there. You know, we will sit there and we'll start to get sleepy, but we won't name it. And so when you're not naming it, you're doing this little dance, but there's not full recognition that the sleepiness is there. There's just this conflict because, you know that you don't want to go into it, but you're not naming it. And what I found very powerful is that if I can actually turn that little switch and actually name it and say, oh, this is sleepiness, something radically changes. The naming of it makes it something that we can step out of just a little bit. So the naming of this moment is suffering. This moment when I'm irritated, or this moment when I'm frustrated, or this moment when I'm just, you know, about to go into rage, or this moment when I'm just feeling such grief. If we can name it and say, this is suffering, we have the opportunity to bring it into our heart, to feel that little ouch, or even the big ouch. Because when we can allow it to touch our heart, then there's a natural response. So the second part of Kristen's formulation for self-compassion is, the second part is to recognize that suffering is a part of life. And this is the Buddha's first noble truth. What we often get caught in identification with our suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, we forget to see that all of us suffer in these very similar ways. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions are for us to contemplate internally, externally, internally and externally. So to see that not only me, but also you, but all of us, we experience these things. That we're not isolated in our suffering. But others suffer just like me. That each one of us has known an experience of anger. Each one of us has known an experience of frustration. Each one of us has known an experience of loneliness, or separation, heartbreak. It's not unique. It's a part and parcel of being a human being. The third element of Kristen's formula is the thought, or the reflection of, may I be kind to myself in this moment. So first I recognize it. This is a moment of suffering. And then I recognize I'm not the only one who suffers like this. And then the third piece is this, may I be kind to myself in this moment. This is that tending and befriending. And I actually see it not as something that we do, but it's something that when we let that suffering touch our heart, that it's a natural response to the ouch. It's the natural response that says, ooh, that hurts, and I want to do something about it. I want to hold that, or I want to comfort that, or I somehow want to alleviate that. So if we can connect to that, then it doesn't make sense to fight against that moment of suffering, but instead to tenderly care for it with kindness. It's not about making ourselves be kind. Because sometimes we hear that statement, may I be kind to myself in this moment? And we turn it into a directive. Oh, I have to be kind, but I'm really struggling. And now I'm adding more suffering because I'm trying to make something happen. Pema Chodron says it this way, and I really love this quote. She says, genuine compassion comes from the fact that you see your own limitations. You wish to be kind and find that you aren't kind. Then, instead of beating yourself up, you see that that's what all human beings are up against, and you begin to have some kind of genuine compassion for the human condition. And you see how challenging it is to be a human being. You try to be peaceful and never raise your voice, and you find out that you have a lot of rage. The Dharma is about making friends with the groundlessness and discomfort of those feelings. It's not about making rules so those emotions never arise. I think this is the place that we get into a lot of trouble because we get difficult emotions and then somehow we think that it's wrong or it's not okay. You know, being a Buddhist, I shouldn't have these emotions. And instead it's to make room for them, to recognize that as human beings, particularly as human beings who are not yet awakened, we're going to experience these. So in a way, it's actually a little bit of a relief. I think it's not until the third level of awakening where I think anger finally completely is eradicated. So, whew, isn't that kind of nice? You know, you don't have to hold yourself up to this idea of I have to get rid of anger right now because that makes me a bad Buddhist. That it takes quite a bit of awakening. So it's okay. Jane Baraz, James's wife, is a self-compassion teacher, and she says, with self-compassion, we experience our own imperfections as a part of the larger human experience, and we recognize that everyone suffers. This is kind of a, you know, and we sort of know that, but sometimes we need a reminder because we tend to narrow the focus. This summer I was at a peace camp that was held in the Sierra. And there was a large fire pit there. How many of you have ever gone camping at any time? You know what a fire pit kind of looks like. You know, it's a clearing and usually there's a ring of stones and, you know, it's just to kind of keep the fire safe. You can have a fire there. And I like to use that analogy about our practice, of considering that our practice creates this fire pit. You know, in a fire pit, it's pretty safe. You can put your wood in there and you can light it and you can have a pretty big fire. And it's pretty safe because there's a lot of space around, there's nothing flammable, there's just rocks that can get hot. But it's really pretty safe. And so we might consider that strong emotion could be like the fire in the fire pit. And if we have a good mindfulness practice, we could actually watch the fire and tend the fire carefully so that we make sure that it doesn't escape. We don't have to get excited about it. We don't have to get frantic about it. But if we get frantic and think, oh my gosh, there's a fire, and we start trying to put it out, and maybe we jump in there and start trying to stomp on it, or we get sticks and we try to, you know, shove the things out of the fire, then it gets dangerous because maybe sparks can fly out, or we kind of accidentally, you know, kick a piece of burning wood out, and then we could have a wildfire. You might think of that in terms of your emotions, but sometimes an emotion can arise, and if we just give it the space and tend to it carefully, it doesn't have to cause any fires outside. You know, think of it as being a safe container so that we don't let the sparks go out and ignite other sparks around us. Okay? And if anybody knows anything about fires, fires do take a little bit of attention in terms of how they burn. Have you ever tried to start a fire? Sometimes they're pretty hard to start because you have to get the material just so. But, you know, if it's burning pretty well, there are things that you can do to tend it. You know, you can start to push material away if you don't want the fire to get bigger. You can do little things like that that mitigate the fire, but keep it safe. And really, as long as you're not adding more fuel, it'll eventually burn out. So, in a way, our mindfulness practice becomes the tender, the caretaker of whatever arises in that fire pit. And as long as we don't get excited about it, as long as we don't think, I have to do something, oh my gosh, this is terrible, oh, there's a fire. And know that if we keep the space around it, and if we don't add gasoline, and if we don't add fuel, it'll burn itself out, it'll be okay. But maybe it's just the embracing of it and just watching it carefully so it doesn't escape, that we can be good caretakers. So it's important that we see that, because sometimes we can go into judging or blaming or in some way shaming or demeaning ourselves because we think, oh my gosh, this fire has started. Instead, just to recognize it's a process that we can watch and we can take care of kindly to make sure nobody gets burned. You know, like if little kids are running around, you don't want them to get burned, so you keep them clear of the fire. Don't watch out. There's a fire here. It's a little dangerous to get too close. But we can hold it a little differently instead of being in conflict with it, or instead of being aversive to it, that it can actually be held in a different way, with a different perspective. So Jeff Foster, who's a writer and spiritual teacher, writes, "No emotion is a mistake. Awakening is not about deleting or transcending human emotions. For how would the ocean transcend a single wave? Or how would the sun transcend one of its beloved sunbeams? It's about seeing that every emotion, from joy to despair, bliss to boredom, agony to ecstasy, is only a movement of life energy, actually a movement of yourself, a wave in your vastness. No emotion is a threat, an enemy, or a punishment. Every emotion is an invitation to remember your vastness, rest in your oceanic nature, You are on a pathless path of radical inclusion, friend, and there are no mistakes here. I think that's, you know, the element of our practice is this radical inclusion. And sometimes we get wrapped up in this idea of, oh, you know, I have to include it, but I'm at odds with it. And so how do we lower the armored heart that this is not okay? Is there a way that we can touch that and allow that to come in? To include it all rather than to say, oh, only part of it is okay. So the shift in our practice comes when we invite more space. Rather than trying to fix what we think of as a problem, reframing that it's not a mistake. And it's something that occurs because of our humanness. And so the invitation here is to change the perspective and not contract from whatever arises. So I want to give you a little visual. Sometimes when we sit in meditation or even in our own lives, something comes up that we don't want or that's really challenging. Maybe it's pain, or maybe it's just some particular thought. And I like to use the image that it's as if this thing here is the problem that I'm perceiving, or is the thing that's challenging. And it's right here in front of my face, blocking my vision. You ever had that? Because your vision literally just gets filled with that one thing. You know, your vision turns narrow, it turns into this tunnel, and the only thing you see is that. Right? And so if I use that image, and I've got this in front of my face, it's kind of blocking my view. But if I remind myself, I'm in a large room, and this is just a part of what's in the room, it's like taking this and putting it into perspective. And now it's just a part of a larger space. And there's lots of room for this to be here. It doesn't take up all of my vision. It doesn't take up all of my focus. And sometimes in practice we can reframe. Sometimes it's just the noticing that you have a whole body, not just that one part that's telling you, this is really important and you have to do something about me. So it's that noticing, wow, you know, I have feet and I have hands and I have a head and I have, you know, this body that's sitting in a chair or sitting on a cushion, and it's not just the one little throb that's in my knee or in my butt or wherever it is. And when I take it into that perspective, suddenly there's a shift. There's a shift that allows a little more space for that thing to be there. And I don't have to make anything happen other than shift the perspective. And sometimes if I think, wow, this body is too small to hold it, I can remember the size of the room. You know, I can actually recognize there's a lot of space here. Often when we walk into a room, the thing that we fixate on are the objects in the room. But if you look up, you might notice there's a lot of space here. So it's just a matter of changing our perspective, changing the focus, to recognize there's a lot of room. There's a lot of space for whatever it is happening. In the perspective of our lives, you know, we have these little blips that in the moment we think is monumental. And then the next day you go, what was so bad about that thing that happened yesterday? Right? Or a year from now you go, wow, was there something that was bothering me a year ago? I don't even remember. Right? So it's this idea of shifting perspective that can be so helpful. And it allows the heart to open rather than to stay defended. When we have this narrow vision, it contracts, it literally contracts our view, contracts our focus, or it contracts the whole awareness to that one thing. So this is both our practice, and it's a result of practice. As the heart can relax more, I can more naturally meet whatever experiences arise from this place of tending and befriending rather than fighting or fleeing. And when I find that my heart's contracted, or when I find that I'm reactive, I can shift my attention intentionally to remind myself there's more space. Rather than having to make something happen in terms of having to fix the problem, I can just give the problem a little more space. I don't have to change it. Knowing that it's a fire, that when the fuel runs out, it'll be gone. So it's about being radically honest. This is how it is. To meet the pain or the dukkha of it. And then to allow the heart to respond in a natural way, which is to meet it with kindness and compassion. From the Metta Sutta, I think this speaks about this same kind of quality, about knowing of suffering. I'm using a translation from Andy Olinsky. But there's two verses in there towards the end of the sutta. Let no one work to undo another. Let no one think badly of anyone. Either with anger or with violent thoughts, one should not wish suffering on others. Just as a mother would watch over her son, her one and only son, with her life, in just the same way, develop a mind unbounded toward all living creatures. And I think it's this allowing suffering to touch our heart that we recognize we would not want to wish suffering on anyone else. You know, when we know our own suffering, when we know the pain of it, we don't want anybody else to suffer in that way. Even if they were our enemy, you know? Sometimes I think, gosh, these things that arise in my meditation practice, ooh, some of it can be quite hellish. And I think, I wouldn't want to wish that on anybody. So when we can connect to suffering and knowing suffering intimately, then it's really hard for us to wish suffering on somebody else. Really hard to want to inflict any more suffering on anyone else, because we know how challenging it is for ourselves. And so it's that same quality of a mother, you know, wanting to protect her child and to offer her child, you know, her protection. And one of the things we have to remember about this, because sometimes we tend to take metta and we are really good at sending it out, we have to include ourselves. This is so important, to not forget ourselves in the equation. To recognize when we're suffering, we need that too. We need the care of that mother to hold us in our suffering, so we can be that as well for ourselves. I want to end with a short poem by Dorothy Hunt. I might have read this before, I'm not sure. It's called "Peace Is This Moment Without Judgment." Do you think peace requires an end to war? Or tigers eating only vegetables? Does peace require an absence from your boss, your spouse, yourself? Do you think peace will come some other place than here? Some other time than now? In some other heart than yours? Peace is this moment without judgment. That is all. This moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. Peace is this moment without thinking that it should be some other way, that you should feel some other thing, that your life should unfold according to your plan. Peace is this moment without judgment, this moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. And I think that's the essence of the Buddhist teachings. How do we find peace in this moment, just as it is? Nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. Not a never-ending project. And, I'll add something from Suzuki Roshi, and you can always improve. There's always room for improvement. So thank you for your kind attention. We have a few minutes, so I'm happy to take questions or comments.
I like what you had to say about tend and nurture, protect. You use that analogy of the mother, protect. I get a little hung up on that because protect brings me back to the fight or flight.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you're protecting somebody, it suggests that there's something external that's going to possibly act and harm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that when you at first thought, oh, that's a neat way to look at it, but then it does take me back to fight or flight. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so there can be a quality that can be maybe perhaps spurred by fear. And I think the tend and befriend is actually something that flies in the face of fear. Kelly talks about a friend of hers that was running in the Boston Marathon. And this friend was just coming into the finish line when the attacks happened. And so she heard this commotion, and at first she thought, oh, there's fireworks, I'm coming into the finish line. And then she noticed people running in the opposite direction. And she actually started running toward the commotion. And she started helping people who were on the ground. And it turned out that the responders, emergency responders, actually had to persuade her to leave. But her focus was so much on helping that there was no element of fear, that she actually went into danger. And when you think about these kinds of disasters, you know, people don't actually consider, is my life on the line? They're just responding because the heart moves and says, you know, recognizes, you know, this is my interpretation, we recognize the vulnerability of being human. And we recognize that we're quite fragile. You know, each one of us is quite fragile. And there's a movement that says, I need to protect. But it doesn't come from a place of anger, it doesn't come from a place of fear, but it comes actually from a place of a very positive emotion or a very positive frame of mind. You know, you might even think about in some of these school shootings, you know, where people have actually gone in the line of fire, and some people have actually died trying to protect these children. And I don't think any of them, you know, were weighing the odds, going, I wonder how safe it is to do this. It was just the movement of, this is the right thing to do, and this is what I need to do. I think the movement towards contraction, which is what you're talking about, comes from our thoughts of projecting what might happen. And this is where we often get caught in our rumination and all of our ideation of the what-ifs. And so this tending and befriending is actually a little bit more of, this is what's called for in this moment, and we do the appropriate thing, as opposed to armoring. Because the armoring actually requires some idea of future harm or something, is what I think. But also, I think there's something that is actually healthy. So there can be an appropriate response that says, yes, I do have to be protective, right? Sometimes people misunderstand compassion, and they think compassion is really weak, and it lets people walk all over them. You know, we come to Buddhist practice, and we think, oh, we should let go, you know, let people get their way. But it's not that at all. Sometimes it's actually having a healthy boundary. I remember a story that Sharon Salzberg used to share, where she was in India, and she was being accosted in the marketplace. And she went back to Manindraji, and she said, what am I going to do? You know, I go to the marketplace, and I'm getting harassed. And Manindra said, take your umbrella, you know, because they would have an umbrella for shade. And he said, with all the loving kindness in your heart, you know, stop that person, right? Hit them over the head or something. But there's a quality in that, and think about it. There's this quality of actually kindness, you know, that we can hit somebody over the head with a different intention. An intention that's motivated by anger or fear, in which we might actually cause quite a bit of harm. But an action in which we act with kindness in our heart will actually mitigate the damage. It may be, oh, I have to do what I need to do to stop that attack. But without anger in our heart, we're not going to continue to do harm. It might be just to disarm that person or disable that person so that they can't harm you. So I think that's the difference, is there's a different quality of heart that we're talking about here in the tending and befriending that doesn't come from a place of contraction, but it actually comes from a quite warm place of openness. And so that takes practice, because it's asking us to be vulnerable. You know, think about it, when you're with a friend or you see a friend, a longtime friend, you know, you go and you want to hug them and you open your arms. This is a place, this is a position of extreme vulnerability, because your whole heart is bare, your whole chest is bare, your internal organs are unprotected, you're literally having your hands out. And to consider, what would that be like to have that open heart with somebody who might be challenging. Right? And this is what our practice is how do we meet whatever it is that's challenging with vulnerability rather than with walls. But the vulnerability can be quite strong as well. Because vulnerability allows us to respond. So I'm going to use an example out of maybe sports. If any of you have ever done any kind of sports, think about maybe basketball or maybe tennis or something in which you need to move and respond. If you stand there and you're really tight and tense, you can't move very quickly. Try that sometime. If you tense up all your muscles and then you need to move in some direction, it's really hard. But if you actually relax all of the muscles, you can still have a little bit of alertness. But if you're relaxed, you have the ability to respond in many different directions. But the moment that you tense, it's really hard to respond. So this is the paradox, I guess, of vulnerability, is how do we not tense up? How do we not freeze up? How do we not contract, but actually stay open? And in staying open, you have the possibility of responding in so many other ways. It becomes limitless. And the moment that we contract, our possibilities to respond get limited. They get locked in. And it's like Suzuki Roshi talks about beginner's mind, right? That the expert who thinks he knows everything is limited. But if you have a mind that comes from a place of a beginner, you're not limited by anything. You know, think about that. When you think that you know something, you zero in and you only see that. And so when you think, oh, I don't know anything, then every possibility is there. This is how sometimes thinking out of the box happens. You know, because when we think we know the animal, then we limit the possibilities. But when we hold that whole thing open and have the possibility, maybe I don't know what that is, then we can actually see other solutions. So this is the beauty of that, but it's also the challenge. In the back.
I was thinking of the subtitle of your topic, the difficult emotions.
Yeah.
And even in regard to the answer that you just gave,
yeah,
the paradox. The analogy of the ring of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking that the fire often has a quality of warmth, that there's an invitation to that. And so just, you know, the directions that you went, the vastness and letting it dissipate. But then I kept coming back to the fire and wondering if there, in that paradoxical sense, if there is even a possibility of a different quality to a difficult emotion.
Yeah.
I'm asking. I
like where you're going. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting question, right? So even the Buddha would say, you know, to investigate or to not lock down. You know, sometimes we do that. We lock down on a particular thing and we think, oh, this is pain, for example. I'll give you that analogy because I recall a particular experience in which I was sitting in meditation and I thought that what I was experiencing was pain. So this is a broad concept, right? We name it, but in investigating it, what I found was that it actually didn't hurt, but it was very strong in intensity. So the actual physical experience was not what I would call painful. But I had thought that it was painful because I didn't want to be with the intense sensation. So my fear of the intensity of that experience kept me away, and I named it pain. And so then I had aversion to it, which then exacerbated the whole thing and exaggerated what I was experiencing. But when I could actually open to having some curiosity, what are those sensations? Can I actually kind of touch those sensations with the mind in a way that didn't categorize it? Then it could actually be seen as an intense sensation that maybe had some qualities of vibration or heat or energy. But it wasn't what I thought it was initially, right? So I could have a different relationship to it, and I could recognize that the part that was freaking me out was the intensity. And that if I could actually recognize it's just intense, I had more space for it. Right? So maybe, you know, there's this quality of investigating, and maybe you find something different there. Thank you. So it is 9:08, and I don't know how late we. Okay. So I will thank you all for your kind attention, and whatever was beneficial, may you take it with you, and if it wasn't, feel free to leave it here. And I'd like to appreciate all of you that come to maybe point out that when you come together in a group, you support one another. And even though you may not necessarily talk to one another, your presence supports everybody else here. That if you came here and found an empty room, it would be very different. And so just meditating together or practicing together, that there's something that happens in a group, and so your presence actually is beneficial and supportive and is valuable. And also, if you walk out of here with a little kinder heart or a little more patient heart or a little more tending and befriending quality, that everything that we do, even though it may seem like you're here and you're working on yourself and you're working on your practice, it ripples out into your families or into your friends, into people that you interact with. And so it's really important to recognize that as you change, people around you actually get affected and they change in ways that we don't necessarily know or that we don't necessarily control, but in a way it's kind of like Gandhi's thing of, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world. That if you change, other people actually respond to that, and they change in different ways too. So may the blessings of our practice and our work together, may that ripple out into positive benefit for all beings in the world.